Welcome to season four of the Raise Your Game Show, a podcast that unpacks and dissects the strategies and principles of high performance in sports and business. I'm your host, Alan Stein Jr.
Let's do it.
In this season, I unpack the key stories and lessons from my book, Raise Your Game. High performance secrets from the best of the best. If you've already read or listened to my book, please enjoy the reinforcement and reminders. Remember, repetition is not punishment. If this is all new to you, I hope you find this content helpful. You can order the full audiobook at audible.com or wherever audiobooks are sold. You can also order the paperback or hard copy version for you or your entire team or organization at raiseyourgamebook.com. Before I dive in, I wanted to announce that Your Game Plan, Student Athlete Edition, is coming soon. This online course was strategically designed by me to help middle school, high school, and college athletes improve their leadership, communication, and habits, as well as become the best version of themselves on and off the court or field. Here are a few samples of the lessons taught. But, you know, hopefully the coach has articulated with some clarity kind of the vision of the culture and the standards and the expectations and what they're hoping to accomplish for everybody. But then I think it's the student athlete needs to take it upon themselves to go in and sit down and say, what is my role? How do you see my puzzle piece fitting in amongst everybody else? And let the coach, again, say with great clarity, your strengths and weaknesses, how they see the season unfolding and what your role will be. And this is what's most important for a student athlete, to simply sit back and listen and take all of the information in. Things that will certainly help you in your sport, but things that will help you in the classroom, things that will help you in your family situation and in your community and relationships with friends, things that you know will help you whenever you stop playing the sport, you know, whether that's after high school or after college or maybe for a select few after you play professionally. But what types of skill sets give you the most bang for your buck in everything that you do? And the ones that come to mind immediately for me are leadership. You know, every industry at every level needs quality and competent leaders. So any investment you make into your ability to lead better is a very sound investment. Make sure you follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Alan Stein Jr. or keep listening to the rest of this season for more info. In today's episode, we explore Chapter 1 from the player section, which focuses on self-awareness. Embrace the people who tell you you're full of crap. Gary Vaynerchuk. Here's a foundational argument for the rest of this book. The single most important thing a person needs for success is self-awareness. This includes who you are, what you can do, what you can't do, where your values come from, and where you need improvement. Nothing I teach or preach in this book will matter if you don't start here. Self-awareness is not just the most important quality, it's the hub of all the others. In today's business world, recognizing your edge and your deficits is the go-to skill. What to capitalize on, what to hone, where to build, where to delegate, it's all part of that pool of self-awareness. Self-awareness is not something you just do as a once-in-a-while inventory thing at the start of a project or a job or at the end of the year. It's far too important for that. It's a habit that you have to cultivate and sharpen every single day. Remember that. Practicing self-awareness is a habit. When Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey, a pioneer in advanced statistics, was asked what things he wished he could forecast about his players, he answered, "Do they have the self-awareness of where they're not as good as they need to be? Meaning, do they understand there's a gap between them and Chris Paul or James Harden or any of these great players in the league? And then, what are their habits to improve that gap?" Self-awareness is like the arrow on the Google map. You start there, figuring out where you are. Then it's about the commitment to do what needs to be done to get you where you want to be. The best performers observe themselves closely. Business journalist Jeff Colvin wrote, "And talent is overrated, what really separates world-class performers from everyone else." In the book, Colvin looked at what distinguishes top performers in all arenas and found they are in effect able to step outside themselves, monitor what is happening in their own mind, and ask how it's going. Top performers do this much more systematically than others do. It's an established part of their routine. I've given many corporate talks around the country, and I would argue that most people are sleepwalking through their work routine, or at the very least, comfortably on autopilot. Be honest. How often do you take this kind of inventory of yourself? Is it a daily habit? If not, ask yourself how you can make it one. It will be a game-changing decision and will lead to growth on a variety of different levels. Here's a self-test. Number one, what do you do really well? Number two, what do you need to improve on? Number three, what is your plan for addressing number two? Meeting the Gary V, the whole ballgame. Gary Vaynerchuk is booked down to the second. When I called his office for an interview for my podcast, his assistant said, the next time he'll have a 30-minute window is 3 months from now. I'll take it, I said, because I'm not stupid. Serial entrepreneur, marketing expert, and investor Gary Vaynerchuk is already a legend. He's like a flash of light, a meteor across the media landscape whose effect is still being felt. But his beginnings were incredibly humble. Gary is the son of immigrant parents from the Soviet Union. When he was growing up, his father owned a wine store in New Jersey where Gary worked from a very young age. In 2006, Gary started a wine show on YouTube, back when that was still called a webcast and people were just figuring out what YouTube even was. In just 5 years, he helped his father grow a $3 million retail store into a $60 million online wine business. Not resting on his laurels, he then parlayed that into VaynerMedia, which is now a $300 million consulting business and one of the world's hottest digital agencies. Along the way, Gary became a prolific angel investor and venture capitalist, investing in companies including Snapchat, Facebook, Twitter, Uber, and Venmo, and co-founding the Vayner RSE Fund. One day, he'd like to buy the New York Jets. Unlike most people, this is a totally realistic goal for him. 3 months after that phone call, I was at VaynerMedia in Gary's New York office. It was surprisingly small given that it's his company, but Gary doesn't come off as the kind of guy who cares about pomp and circumstance. The walls and shelves were covered in sports memorabilia, mostly Jets and Knicks, along with framed pictures of his book covers and photographs of Gary with various celebrities and big-time influencers. His office had a comfortable sports bar feel to it, a place you can imagine killing an afternoon in. It was designed for function. There was a stand-up desk with a computer and a small conference table with four chairs for meetings. One wall was floor-to-ceiling glass with no blinds, so everyone could see into his office 24/7. The whole vibe was approachable transparency, just like Gary. At 9 a.m. on the dot, he walked in, passionate and fully present, telling me he was fired up after hearing my podcast opening theme music. Gary has this rapid-fire, intense way of talking that just ropes in his audience. It's hard to focus on anything else when he's in a room. He is who he is, and he doesn't pretend or apologize. Self-awareness is the game, Gary told me. I think self-awareness is the single most important drug in society. He admitted that it might not be the sexy thing, but it is undoubtedly the most important. When you know yourself, you win, he said. In business, the reason I've been successful is I know what I'm good at and I know what I'm not good at. He later added, if you BS yourself, you never excel. This is the essence of self-awareness, swallowing hard truths and recognizing the real version of you that is staring back in the mirror. Not the you that you wish you were or the you that you'd like to present to the world, the you as you actually are, right here and right now. Despite his enormous success, Gary doesn't shy away from admitting there are things he doesn't know and isn't good at. In fact, his willingness to recognize these is what gives him a competitive edge. I'm sure that many guys who grew up working class and are now worth almost $200 million wouldn't bother to search for those gaps or admit to them, even if they did. But Gary knows he didn't just stumble into success. He carried a commitment to self-awareness that brought him to where he is, and he continues to preach and teach the value of self-awareness. For instance, Gary's a competitive guy, but that's not why he won't let his kids beat him in one-on-one basketball. The reason? He wants them to understand what it takes to beat him. Letting them win would give them a false sense of accomplishment. Because of this, when one of his kids got old enough to genuinely beat him, that victory tasted delicious. Side note to the listener, I completely agree with Gary, and even take this a step further. I won't let my kids beat me in anything. I think the everyone should get a trophy mindset damages self-awareness. Gary knew he had 30 minutes with me, but he never once looked at his watch or phone to see what time it was. Despite having a packed day, he didn't just go through the motions. Gary demonstrated why he's successful. He was fully invested in what he was doing at the moment, looking me in the eye and giving me pure, honest, and direct answers. The whole conversation was hyper-focused and present. If he was like that for a podcast interview, I could only imagine how locked in he is during a meeting or a business call. It's how he approaches everything, and it taught me a great deal about why the successful are where they are. Who you are and what you do. Understanding who you are and what you can offer puts you a step ahead of everyone else. It tells you what to capitalize on and what to improve and sometimes what to avoid. Self-awareness offers the needed element of perspective, the clarity of the big picture and your place in it. The most dangerous people in the world are the ones that don't know what they don't know. Taking a bad shot is one thing. Not knowing it was a bad shot? Now you have a problem. I'm always shocked by how many people don't seem to have that self-awareness. Crossover CEO Vasu Kulkarni told me, knowing your limits, knowing what you're good at, and most importantly, knowing what you're not good at. It seems so fundamental, but that doesn't mean it's common. In fact, like all in-demand skills, the reason self-awareness is so valuable is because it's so rare. Figure out what separates you from everyone else. If you don't know who you are and what you do, how is anyone else going to know? Without self-awareness, you're not going to be able to maximize your potential. And potential is not rare. Look around. The world is full of people with unused, wasted, or lost potential. They fill the seats of arenas around the globe. You have to acknowledge that you have more to learn. It's not humility for its own sake, or to be more likable. It's humility as a path to self-awareness. Here's a self-test. Number one, what specific thing do you do at a very high level? Number two, if I polled the people closest to you, what would they say you do really well? Number three, how many opportunities do you have to do this thing? Clear eyes. Confidence is important, and it is the focus of Chapter 5. But self-awareness requires that you avoid the pitfall of arrogance. Arrogance prevents us from seeing our flaws. Humility gives us 20/20 vision and allows us to stay open. Too many people do not own up to their mistakes and are constantly trying to hide their flaws and shortcomings. I think this is alpha dog nonsense and a recipe for self-destruction. It is a short-term strategy that will cause long-term problems. Own your weaknesses at work, Adam Galinsky and Mari Schweitzer wrote in Friend and Foe, When to Cooperate, When to Compete, and How to Succeed at Both. Be powerful with them. Be the first to admit them, and what follows may surprise you. The experts suggest that one of the key ways to improve your self-awareness is through listening. Think about all of the conversations and meetings where you've just been waiting to talk. What could you have missed? Do you honestly think you're the only one who has anything to offer? You should be least interested in what you have to say. You already know what you know. As counterintuitive as it sounds, a key step to acquiring self-awareness is to ask those who know you best. This is your inner circle, trusted friends, family, and colleagues who know you, love you, challenge you, push you, support you, and want what is best for you. If you ask your inner circle if you are an empathetic listener and they all say no, then it doesn't matter what you think. You are not an empathetic listener. You will have reached a high level of self-awareness when your evaluation of your strengths and weaknesses is aligned with your inner circles. Don't worry about them. Let them worry about you. John Wooden. Control the controllables. Self-awareness is about knowing where your control begins and where it ends. Often, understanding where that line is determines your chances of success. Something I say to my players, to my colleagues, and to my audiences all of the time is control the controllables. There are only two things in this world that we have 100% control over 100% of the time. That is our effort and our attitude. Coming to this epiphany was a tough pill for me to swallow, as I've always skewed a tad toward being a control freak. But it's true. Granted, we can dictate our mindset, enthusiasm, and preparation, all vital ingredients in performance, but these are all still just branches of effort and attitude. Spending our time, focus, and energy on things outside of our control is a poor use of resources. Face it, you have minimal control over your boss, your coworkers, your employees, your colleagues, your customers, your spouse, your friends, or your children. So don't waste your mental, emotional, and physical currency on them. Instead, focus on the two things you actually have control over. You can absolutely impact and influence many of the events and people in your life, but you do not control their behavior, their decisions, or the outcome. So let it go. Invest that energy internally. You'll feel better. I remember my parents telling me as a kid, you don't control what other people do or say, but you do control how you respond and react. As a father of three young children, I've said this exact statement on countless occasions. And it's not only true for children, it's true for all of us. Learning how to control the controllables is imperative to maximizing performance. When you get distracted by things you don't control, your performance suffers. We have limited energy, attention, and resources, so put them where they can actually make a difference. One of the things that separates elite basketball players from average players is this ability to focus on their own effort and attitude. Average players worry about what their coach is doing, what their teammates are doing, what their opponent is doing, even what the referee is doing. Great players process feedback from each of those domains, but they spend each play and practice session focusing on what they're doing and how they process what is happening. They work on their effort and attitude. We decide how we view things and what we do about them. That's it. Everything else is out of our hands. If you don't get that promotion or a new client, you can stew on fault, fairness, and blame. You can spend weeks swimming in that. Lots of people do it. Or you can work on what you do. Which of these options is most likely to lead to that next promotion or client? The lessons of socks and shoes. Controlling the controllables also comes down to basic preparation. Being ready when and where others are not. John Wooden won 10 national championships with the UCLA Bruins, including a record 7 straight titles, a record that is so eye-poppingly insane that I'd wager it will never be broken. How many schools even go back-to-back? Only Florida and Duke have done it since UCLA's streak ended in 1973. Wooden is an icon and a legend, but let's not get confused. He was not a wizard. He worked on what he could. He managed the basics. Every season at UCLA, one of the first things Wooden would do in the locker room was teach his players how to correctly put on their socks and shoes to alleviate chafing and blisters. Most 18-year-olds would laugh off such an instruction, but Wooden had a reputation, so his players trusted him. They knew his record, so they did what he said. Because of this little, seemingly insignificant, almost childish thing, Wooden's players almost never got blisters. By the end of the game, when the other team's feet were aching like blazing coals, Wooden's guys were as fresh as they were at tip-off. Socks and shoes are as basic as you can get, but Wooden understood that the players' game started there. If they couldn't stand up, if they couldn't run, they couldn't execute a single thing he taught them. Start with what you can control. Any time spent on something outside of your attitude or effort is wasted, because it's energy and time away from what you can control. Most people waste a tremendous amount of time and energy complaining. What do they complain about? They complain about everything outside of their control. No one ever seems to complain about their own attitude or effort. It's always someone else's that they find fault with. Complaining is like throwing up, my friend John Gordon likes to say. It makes you feel better, but it makes everyone else feel worse. Focus on your attitude and your effort, and do so consistently. That's how you win. Here's a self-test. Rate yourself on a scale ranging from 1, strongly disagree, to 5, strongly agree. Number 1. I have high expectations for myself and my team. Number 2. I constantly ask questions to my close friends, family, and colleagues. Number 3. I work on my craft daily and am constantly learning and growing. Number 4. I handle pressure well and embrace adversity. Number 5. I am focused on the right things and my schedule is aligned with my priorities. Number 6. I am an active and empathetic listener. Number 7. I communicate clearly and effectively. Number 8. I encourage feedback and questions and I accept criticism well. Number 9. I openly admit when I am wrong and I accept responsibility. Number 10. I have a healthy way of dealing with disappointment, anger, and frustration. Put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket. Andrew Carnegie. One thing well. Focus on who you are and what you do well. That is how you succeed. NBA sharpshooters like Kyle Korver and JJ Redick get paid absurd amounts of money to do one thing. Catch and shoot. That's it. Catch the ball and shoot the ball. And I don't say that to diminish them, but that is what got them to where they are, and it's where their greatness lies. Well-rounded is overrated. Use your self-awareness to double down on what you do best. Find the one thing you do better than anyone else and continue to pour into that. That is a dying idea. Simon Sinek, best-selling author and leadership consultant for Microsoft, Disney, and Airbnb, believes that we've lost the desire and ability to excel in one thing. Giving a lot of oneself to a small number of things, he wrote, seems to have been replaced by giving a little bit of oneself to a large number of things. Own your space. Turn yourself into someone invaluable. Make it so no one else can do what you do. Self-awareness is the key to getting a competitive advantage. It leads to a pattern of utilizing your strengths and managing your weaknesses. It's how you become great, singularly great, at anything. A Gallup poll of thousands of organizations showed that when an organization focused on an employee's strength, the level of that employee's engagement was nearly 75%. And when they didn't, it was 9%. If people don't feel like they're being utilized well, if their strengths are not being tapped, then they're just going to feel like they're being wasted. And they withdraw. Another study of top business executives found that self-awareness was both the highest predictor of performance as well as the least utilized criteria. That pattern emerges again and again. Self-awareness is so basic and yet so exceptional. Be willing to close the store. Self-awareness is not just in the knowing, but in the adjusting and the correcting. On a Tuesday afternoon in 2008, Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz, who had recently taken over a second time at the company he founded, closed every single one of its stores in America. That's over 7,000 stores. The cost? $23 million. The reason? The espresso just wasn't good anymore. That's it. No disease outbreak or food poisoning or lawsuit. It was that simple. The coffee wasn't good. What Starbucks was known for, where its value came from, had become subpar, and Schultz decided to do something about it. Every Starbucks barista in America had to be retrained, so Schultz did what he felt he had to do. He closed all of the stores. Now, Schultz probably could have staggered the training in a series of sessions, and I'm sure his publicity team and accountants wanted him to, but he wanted to make the statement that they had been failing and they were going to correct it. He wanted the public to know they were closing all of the stores. The sign out front of every closed Starbucks even admitted that's what the retraining was for, opening themselves up to a slew of negative press and comments. But Schultz insisted on doing it this way. Soon after, Schultz flew in 10,000 Starbucks managers to a single arena at a cost of $30 million to break some bad news to them. He told them that Starbucks was on the verge of closing within the year because their success had bred laziness and sloppiness. He spoke to all of them openly and honestly and clearly laid down the dire path the company was on if the negative trend continued. The Starbucks experience, the thing that Schultz had built, was vanishing. He needed to bring it back. Schultz became aware of the problems in his organization and took action to stem the tide. 10 years later, Starbucks is again one of the biggest companies and most popular brands in the world. Schultz's self-awareness regarding himself and his company is what saved it and helped it thrive. Know thyself. Self-awareness, especially in hyper-competitive fields, requires stepping outside your bubble. It means understanding yourself the way your competitors do. All campaigning politicians do opposition research on their opponents, and the smartest ones want to get their hands on their opponents' opposition research on them. It's gold because it tells them what they need to work on, where they are vulnerable, and where they're likely to get hit. That's exactly how Eminem's character won the final rap battle in 8 Mile. This type of awareness is key. It helps you see how you size up to the competition and gives you insight into how they might defeat you. Close the holes in your game, whatever your game is. Some people don't like to look at their weaknesses, either because they're so focused on self-esteem or because they don't want to admit that their weaknesses exist. But those who do, those whom others might think don't have any weaknesses, are the ones who have worked like crazy on improving them. But it's important to note that we're only talking about applicable weaknesses. Weaknesses that matter and weaknesses that affect performance. It's okay if Kyle Korver and J.J. Redick are weak rebounders. It's okay if Starbucks doesn't make world-renowned bagels. That isn't what makes them who they are. Work with what you have. Find your competitive advantage. You're dealing with a much larger pool than those in the past. Not too long ago, workers were only competing with potential employees who lived within a commuting distance from the office. Those days are long gone. Now in the information age, the pool is the entire globe. Good enough is no longer good enough. Self-awareness will be your edge, securing that interview, beating out a competitive pool, getting that promotion, or launching that startup. Remember, if you don't know what you do well, no one else will either. Mile 17. Self-awareness tends to develop with age. It's not that it automatically arrives as the years pile on. It's just that the young don't seem to have much use for it. It's funny how maturity works. In my 20s, I thought I knew everything. Now in my 40s, I realize how much I didn't know then, as well as how much more I still need to learn. In 2002, a few years after graduating college, I signed up to run my first marathon. It had always been a goal of mine. Running 26.2 miles just seemed to be the most physically challenging thing a normal person could do. Plus, I was trying to impress a girlfriend who was really into running. I played college basketball, which was incredibly demanding, and had a fairly decent understanding of proper training, but I didn't know a lick about preparing for a marathon. Basketball is an interval-based sport, meaning everything is short duration and high intensity. The whole concept of pacing myself for 26.2 miles was foreign to me. It was apples and oranges. So my preparation and marathon training program was grossly insufficient. My youthful naivete simply thought, a few years ago I was a college athlete. I'll be fine. I was blindly stepping off a ledge, figuring I knew how far the drop would be, but I had no clue. At the start of a marathon, runners are staggered based on their predicted mile pace. You can't have everyone pushing their way to the starting line when the gun goes off. It's impractical. There's no room, and it would make a mess. When I arrived to line up that morning, I had no frame of reference for what my pace would be. I ran a 5:03 mile in college when I was in the best shape of my life, but I wasn't delusional. I knew I couldn't keep that pace for the whole race. So I ventured back to the 8 to 9 minute mile pace, and I took a look around. I saw middle-aged soccer moms and guys in their 60s with gray hair and outdated clothes. No way, I thought. These are old people. I don't belong here. So I inched my way up to a group I thought looked more like me, which turned out to be the 6 minute per mile pace group. Satisfied, I took my place among them. When the race started, it was like I was shot out of a cannon. With my adrenaline pumping, I started off at a lightning-fast pace that would be impossible to sustain. I didn't know it at the time, but the effects of distance running were a little bit like doing shots of tequila at a bar. You feel pretty good after two or three shots, but that fourth one will smash you. Everything feels fantastic until that moment you fall off the cliff. The problem is, you rarely see the cliff coming. You just fall. Your senses drain away, you feel sick, and you lose control. It silently creeps up on you, and then it pounces. That's how the marathon was. At mile 8, I felt great. At mile 12, I felt okay. At mile 17, it all unraveled. When I met Jesse Itzler, entrepreneur and co-owner of the Atlanta Hawks, he told me that every single one of us has this little voice inside of us that's full of self-doubt. When things start getting tough in our lives, physically, mentally, emotionally, that voice gets louder and louder and the negative self-talk begins. It's a self-preservation mechanism. If you're putting yourself through grueling physical pain, your mind is trying to get you to stop. That's what it's there for. Its job is to save you. At mile 17, my little voice started whispering, and I could not shut it up. I'm an all-around positive guy, confident and optimistic in my day-to-day life, but I just didn't have the energy to ignore that voice. Plus, it sounded reasonable. With every step I took, the voice got louder and louder. My mind and body started shutting down. Feeling immensely defeated, I started walking. Prior to that race, I would have bet someone $1 million that I wouldn't have to walk at all, much less the last 9 miles. It was dejecting and humbling, and I felt like a failure. Though part of me would rather ignore what happened next, it's too important, so we'll return to my marathon debacle later in this section. Markell and the Power of Self-Awareness. I have seen self-awareness make or break people in sports, in business, and in life. It is often the difference maker in whether or not someone rises to the top of his field. For 6 years, I was the performance coach for the DeMatha Catholic High School basketball program, a national powerhouse located just outside of Washington, D.C. The school has 6 national championships, 39 conference championships, and has produced 14 NBA players. It holds an iconic and prestigious position in the rarefied world of elite high school basketball. As a quiet and skinny 13-year-old, Markell Fultz attended one of our summer camps. He was a polite and respectful young man who showed signs of potential, but he was well below the level of player we usually recruited. When he expressed interest in attending DeMatha, Coach Mike Jones was direct and honest. "We'd love to have you, but don't plan on making the varsity anytime soon." Markell decided to come to DeMatha anyway, which says a great deal about him and his commitment to the game. He probably could have gone somewhere else, gotten it fully paid for, and been the big dog, but he chose to go with the best, playing for a coach that guaranteed him nothing. This was exceptionally rare. Young players tend to go where they're recruited, but Markell came to us. Most recruited players expect to at least start on junior varsity so they can jump to varsity as soon as possible. But Markell had the humility and awareness to know his level, so he began on the freshman team. He didn't get down or dejected because he was starting at the bottom. He respected the process, worked on his game, and made it up to the JV the next year. Of course, people were buzzing in his ear. "You should be on varsity. You should play at another school." All that noise that comes with coming into your own. But Markell had the self-awareness to block them out. He kept on track, going to the gym, working on his game, and finding a way to raise his level. Self-awareness almost always leads directly to humility. When you know the things you don't do well, you become more humble and driven. Markell put in so much work after his sophomore year that he jumped to the varsity and became one of the best players in the conference and then in the DC area. But even then, after he made it to the top of this prestigious group, he didn't stop. Instead of resting on his laurels, he improved even more from junior to senior year, becoming an All-American and accepting a full scholarship to the University of Washington. It's called self-awareness, but the people you choose to surround yourself with play a part in that. A self-aware person is going to invite healthy criticism, and one way to do that is to not shy away from hearing the truth. It's important to have supportive people who aren't afraid to tell you the things that you need to hear instead of the things you want to hear. The people in Markell's circle helped reinforce his own sense of self. In 2017, Markell was the number one pick in the NBA draft. I wasn't surprised at all. He didn't lose his work ethic, the drive, and the self-awareness, even as the accolades rolled in at college. He stayed focused, even with all of the hype and attention that comes when you're projected to be a top pick. Part of being in the NBA is knowing your part in the whole. Most players can't immediately dominate an NBA court like they did in college, so they have to have the awareness of what their place is among the other four guys in the same color jerseys. Unfortunately, a disappointing thing happened to Markel during his NBA rookie season with the Philadelphia 76ers. A shoulder injury before the season began sidelined him for a month, then 2 months. Then it looked like he'd be out for most of the season. Then grainy cell phone video came out from the Sixers practice arena showing that he had changed his jump shot. People were alarmed. Something just didn't look right. Then the tweeters and commentators had a field day, a Markel watch, where week after week of the number one overall pick sitting on the bench brought theories and criticisms. There was talk of him losing his confidence. There was talk of him being the biggest bust in the NBA draft. It was an unprecedented amount of speculation and scrutiny. But Markel stayed quiet. Then, on a regular season game in March of his rookie season, he returned. And you know what? He was fine. Better than fine. He was great. A month later, he recorded a triple-double. Double digits in points, assists, and rebounds. The youngest player in NBA history to do so. I watched Markel grow each step on his journey, and I know his career will soar exactly as the scouts first predicted. He has the self-awareness to make it in a business where a lot of talented players just don't pan out. He knows who he is, and even with the basketball world watching, he will not get rattled. Here is a self-test. Despite the self in self-awareness, to ensure accuracy, it is important to solicit intentional and purposeful feedback from those who know you best. Your inner circle. As comedians know, there's only one measure of whether or not a joke is funny. Does the audience laugh? It sounds simple, but there's real depth to that concept. You may believe you possess the necessary humility, but if the five people closest to you feel otherwise, then guess what? Identify three people that you feel know you the best. They can be friends, family, or colleagues. You need to create a safe environment for them to share their honest thoughts and feelings. Ask them to share the truth as they see it. Explain what it's for and that you'd appreciate constructive criticism. The more honest the feedback, the more helpful and impactful this exercise will be. Ask them to rate you on the following questions on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being low and 10 being high. Do I communicate well? Do I effectively convey my message? Am I courageous? Am I unafraid to take risks? Am I disciplined? Do I commit to the process of doing things? Am I focused? Can I block out distractions? Am I generous? Am I a giving person? Do I show initiative? Do I start things on my own? Do I use sound judgment? Do I know what is truly important? Do I listen? Do I hear others or only hear what I want to hear? Am I optimistic? Do I choose to see the good in every situation? Am I a resolver? Do I just identify problems or actually fix them? Am I responsible? Do I hold myself accountable? Am I secure? Do I trust those around me? Once you've collected their feedback, see how it compares to the other people you gave it to. See how it compares to how you see yourself. Look for the trends and patterns. Identify your top strengths and your most glaring weaknesses. What sticks out? It's important not to jump to conclusions or judgment. Remember, this is simply feedback. The results themselves are neither positive or negative. You decide whether or not to use them in a way that serves you and moves you forward, or to use them in a way that hinders you. We can't change what we don't notice. Tony Schwartz, author and journalist. The fogged up mirror. There's a contradiction at work when we talk of self-awareness. You have to notice if you have it, and that ability is the very thing you're looking to build. Because of this catch-22, I don't think you can ask people if they are self-aware and ever get anything other than a yes. That's the tricky thing about it. they can't see their own blind spots. In fact, 95% of people, when surveyed, claim to be self-aware. Virtually no human on the planet would admit to not being self-aware, but the vast majority are not. I think this comes from a lack of understanding of what self-awareness means. There's a phenomenon called the Dunning-Kruger effect, which put simply is, we can't know everything that we don't know. Dunning and Kruger were two Stanford researchers who found that the subjects who did the worst on their tests were regularly the most confident. There's an emotional aspect too, a type of denial at work. Just about everyone can rattle off what they're good at. But then there's the lurking stuff no one wants to address, the things that scare them, that challenge them, that might keep them up at night. When we tend to look away from what we can't do, we avoid digging deeper and uncovering how to do something about them. It's easier to ignore them or blame outside forces. We live a lie that we keep telling ourselves, so our level of self-awareness is weak or even non-existent. That's where the real hard work comes in, being able to look in the mirror and know what we're scared of and what we're insecure about. We are taught to suppress or avoid our adversity and pain, but we have to look at that if we're going to get anywhere. It's where we all have to start. Key point. Learn your strengths and weaknesses inside and out because self-awareness makes everything possible. Remember, if you don't know who you are and what you do, nothing you know or learn will matter. Control the controllables. Don't get caught up in the things outside your frame of influence. Recognize what you can contribute, where your value is, and others will notice, and they will reward you for it. Avoid the arrogance that blinds you to areas in which you need to improve.
Well, that's it for me. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please make sure to join my conversations at Alan Stein Jr. on all major social platforms and go to alansteinjr.com to subscribe to my full timeout, 30-second timeout, and overtime monthly emails. I look forward to helping you raise your game.